You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
10, 9, 8, 7, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition, 2, 1, 0, we have a liftoff. We have a liftoff and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center as the second flight is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
And welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Entertainment in association with the Earth Station One Network. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. Plexico, and this week I'm joined by my semi-regular co-host on the White Rocket Show and my regular co-host on the AU Wishbone Show, John Ringer. Welcome back aboard the rocket, John.
Thanks for having me, Van. Very excited to be here.
Well, we always have fun talking about whatever topic we come up with, and this seemed like a good time to talk about Star Wars. We're recording this on Monday night before the Friday that it opens, December the 18th. This is December the 14th, and John and I were talking about maybe reviewing the movie together, and we thought, well, if we're going to review it, how about we do an episode before we see it where we kind of establish our history with this property? Because, I mean, I think you probably agree, right, that it is, if not the cornerstone of modern sci-fi fantasy pop culture, it's right, you know, it's in that pantheon.
Oh, it's there.
Yeah.
It's it.
And so I just figured we would go through and just kind of talk about it on a personal level. The original movie, the other movies, the prequels, the whole thing. Now, we're not going to go into all kind of super depth. We'd have to have hours to talk about all the books and the comics and everything else, unless we just touch on something as we go by. But we're really just going to talk about the phenomenon itself and kind of on a personal level. So I don't want to waste any time. Let's just dive right on into it. The first question I have for you, and then I'll throw out my answer, is you saw it when it first came out, correct? Because we're almost the same age.
I did.
Okay. What do you remember about the whole experience of it being out and you hearing about it and you getting to go and your reaction and all that?
I was 8 years old when Star Wars came out in 1977. And I went and, you know, Star Wars, you know, episode 4, A New Hope, as it was retitled later. But at the time, to me, I just say Star Wars in reference to that movie.
Exactly.
And I remember my parents took us to the movie, and it was a theater we didn't normally go to. I hadn't been to a lot of movies at that point. And it was a theater we didn't normally go to, but they had Star Wars, and we went. And I didn't know anything about it. Some of my friends had seen it already and said it was awesome, but I had no idea what to expect. Mm-hmm. And it was unbelievable to an 8-year-old boy, that movie. I mean, again, this is not – it's a very different world from where we live now in 2015.
Exactly.
You know, we had three TV channels, the mm-hmm. three networks, and we had TBS. And there was no internet.
Dude, we didn't even have TBS.
We had ITS because I lived in Atlanta.
Right.
TBS only showed the Braves.
You had it over the air. That's the thing.
Yeah,
so we didn't have cable.
It over the air. So
right.
We didn't have cable. We got TBS in the antenna. So
right. Yeah.
And that was it. You know, I mean, I had read a, you know, I didn't know if I really started reading science fiction or fantasy books then, because I was only 8. And I'd probably not even reading comic books or anything. So it was a mind-blowing experience for an 8-year-old boy. It was the most amazing thing. And I remember some of my friends got some of the action figures that Christmas after it was over. And that's all like all we did for the next year was run around and play those little action figures.
So how did the movie itself kind of impact you in terms of the story, and I mean, what did you think about it and everything?
Well, I mean, it was up until that point, I guess probably I had only seen like children's films, kids movies, Disney movies or whatever. And right. So to go from that to seeing that Star Wars movie in the theater was amazing. Mm-hmm. And it was just so much more exciting and intense. And the special effects were unbelievable for that time period. The spaceships and the lightsaber duels and the aliens and the cantina and all that kind of stuff. I mean, that was just in the droids. It was amazing. And I mean, that was the part that really stuck with me. And then also just the idea that there was this huge story and that it wasn't over.
Right.
That the bad guy got away and, that there might be more or whatever. That was, it was so great. It was also, a similar story to ones you'd heard before, because it was a story of a young boy being tutored by an older guy, and then learning the ways to fight, and then fighting in a big battle and, saving everyone. So there was some kind of like a King Arthur kind of thing or other things there you'd heard. But as an 8-year-old, it was the most exciting thing I had ever seen in my whole life.
Well, you opened up a lot of things there that I'm dying to follow up on, but I'll give my little version of that real quick, and then we can dig into that. It came out in May of 77, and I had been 9 for just a few months, and like you said, in rural Alabama, we had the ABC channel that was pretty clear in Birmingham, we had the NBC channel that was okay, and we had PBS, the public broadcasting system, Channel 10. And on a good day, you could get the CBS channel 42, but it was very staticky because it was the UHF channel and it wasn't as good a signal. Mm-hmm. And so I had been watching maybe reruns of the original Star Trek and Space 1999 right before then, and it was just starting to get into non-kiddie science fiction stuff. I was enjoying the $6 Million Man, and Star Trek and Space 1999, those were like my favorite shows in the mid-70s. So I was ready for something that would kind of blow the roof off. And two things indicated to me it was coming. One was that I saw a TV – I only remember seeing one TV commercial for it. And it was such a blur, I don't even remember anything about what was in it. All I can remember is seeing, I think, maybe the stormtroopers doing something maybe on the Death Star. Mm-hmm. And then I remember after that thinking, that is the coolest looking thing I've ever seen in my life. I must see this immediately. But of course, in Sylacauga, we weren't going to get it until like Christmas. Mm-hmm. We had a one screen theater in Sylacauga. And the idea of going to Birmingham or Montgomery to see a movie, my age, there was just no way. I mean, my older sister might have been doing that with her boyfriend or something, but there was no way I was ever going to get to go to Birmingham just to see a movie. No, that was unheard of. So we just had to wait for things to come to our theater. And so we went, my sister and I and my parents and my stepbrother, we all went to Daytona Beach right after it came out, right after Star Wars came out. And our tradition was we would go see one movie that was out while we were at Daytona. And Lisa had, my sister had the novel. She had the little novelization of it that she was reading. I remember that. And I remember looking at it and thinking, oh, that we got to see that. And I was just begging my parents, please, we have to see Star Wars. And we went, but my stepbrother said, no, I want to see the new James Bond movie, The Spy Who Loved Me. And so we went and saw the new James Bond movie, The Spy Who Loved Me. I have never, we may have talked about this before on the James Bond.
I think we did it on the James Bond
show. Yeah, I have never forgiven that James Bond movie. It will never be one of my favorite James Bond movies just because it kept me from seeing Star Wars. And so someday I'll forgive my parents and my stepbrother. I don't know. I'll let you know if it ever happens. But So I finally got to see it in Sylacauga. I saw it three times. I think I saw it each time they released it. Because remember, they released it for several months, yes. And then it went away, and then it came back.
Oh, yes.
I had never seen any movie in the theater more than once, and I saw it three times in the theater because that was the only way we had to see it.
That's right.
And
I mean, this is pre-VCRs even.
Yeah.
So if you were going to see the movie more than once, I mean, unless it was going to come on TV at some point in the future, you had to see it in the theater.
A couple of years later, I had a couple of things else. Well, I think maybe 78 or 79, I got an audio cassette, like goes in a tape recorder. I got an audio cassette for Christmas from Sears that had about 30 minutes of audio and music from Star Wars on it. And so those particular scenes that were on that tape, I have utterly memorized because I played that tape till it wore out. It was all I had.
Mm-hmm.
And then a couple of years later when video discs came out, do you remember video discs?
Oh, yes.
Not laser discs, but the ones that actually look like a phonograph record.
Yes, big.
I had a Star Wars one of those.
Wow.
I must have watched that thing 100 times all the way through. I memorized that movie just watching it over and over on video disc. So, but that was like 81, 82, you know, 83. So back in, you know, when the movie came out, the only way you had to see it was just go see it over and over.
That's right.
And I think tickets were like $1.50.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. So that's kind of how we came into it and everything. And of course, the other movies, we were just panting in anticipation. What do you think about Star Wars and its impact on popular culture? I mean, what has it meant to you in the years since then, and what has it meant to all of our popular culture, do you think?
That's a good question. I think a lot of it, I mean, to me, it's kind of a foundational thing in popular culture because I saw it at that age and I saw the sequels, and then I went back and saw them again in the re-releases as a teenager, you know, that everything else after that was compared to that.
Exactly.
Every other movie was, you know, trying to capture what Star Wars had, often unsuccessfully.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, so it really was this kind of totem in popular culture that everything else I judged it by.
Yeah.
And the other thing that in terms of popular culture was, you know, the toys. I mean,
oh yeah,
merchandise.
Absolutely.
You know, the little 3-inch figures, the X-Wings and the TIE Fighters and the
there hadn't really been Land anything. Spears. There had never been such a diverse, you know, collection. I remember having Star Trek action figures that were about 6-7 inches, those Mego size, mm-hmm. 6-7 inch tall, but they only had like 5 or 6. Star Wars gave you eventually every character that even appeared for a split second in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Just tons of characters as action figures.
Oh, as it went along. Yeah. Even the really obscure, you know, your IG-88s and those kind of people, the cantina characters.
Every alien in the cantina got an action figure pretty much eventually. It was hilarious. Yeah.
So that was great. I mean, we loved to take all those guys and play with them. And that was, you know, that was a big part of that growing up that time. And, you know, other toys and stuff didn't seem to compete with a lot of that. So
yeah, I remember that I desperately wanted a lot of that stuff and never really got it. I would beg for a couple of dollars and go down to Gibson's or Kmart or something and get. I remember I had the Stormtrooper, and I remember I had R2-D2, and maybe Luke Skywalker and maybe Darth Vader. I do remember going in and getting R2-D2.
Mm-hmm.
When I was, I guess, 9, 10 years old, and I remember coming back out to the car, and my grandparents were sitting there in the car, and I had begged them for like $2 or $2.50, whatever it cost, to get you know, an action figure, and I came back out with R2-D2, and I opened the little blister pack and got him out and started clicking his little round, you know how you turn the top and you go click, click, and I remember my granddad looked at that and went, "You paid $2.50 for a little thing that goes click, click?" And I'm like, it's R2-D2. And he just rolls his eyes and shakes his head and drives on. They didn't. Talk about generational. That generation did not get Star Wars at all. It just went over their head completely. In fact, it's like, who was it? They offered a part two. Oh, there was somebody they offered a part to in Star Wars that was a fairly big actor, and he said he just couldn't understand it, so he turned it down. I can't even remember who it was now. But anyway, that's basically Sean Connery in every billion-dollar movie that's ever been made. He reads it and says, I don't understand it, and then he misses out. So, yeah, on popular culture, I mean, yeah, I mean, you compared everything that came after to it, and everything that came after tried to look like it. I mean, spiritually, that's true now, but, you know, those that aren't as old or haven't been around as long as we have, I mean, in 1978, 79, 80, 81, around in those years, everything tried to look just like Star Wars. I mean, you know, from Buck Rogers tried to have the same spaceships, Battlestar Galactica tried to look exactly like Star Wars.
Cylons.
Battle Beyond the Stars, Star Crash, all those movies and TV shows that came out right at the end of the 70s, they all pretty much, unless they'd already been in development, something like Logan's Run, which was a completely different thing, the ones that were trying to be more space opera, you know, they all tried to emulate that whole thing. Now, I want to break down the movies, but I really want to spend a few minutes here on the first one, because the first one, I think, was the cultural icon. Before we do, let me ask you this. I don't know if all of our listeners know people that know me know my position on this, but I don't know yours. For some reason, we've never talked about this, I don't think, or I've forgotten. There are two kinds of Star Wars fans. Well, honestly, you know what? There's three. There used to be two kinds of Star Wars fans. Now there's three. There's one kind that thinks Star Wars, and they call it Star Wars, is the best of all. There's another kind that thinks The Empire Strikes Back is the best of all. And then there's another kind who is a much younger generation who thinks The Phantom Menace is maybe not the best of all, but it's really good.
Come on.
No, I'm serious. John, I teach college, you know, every day. And I have these conversations during breaks and stuff with my students that are into this kind of stuff. I had a long break argument debate with one of my students, you know, probably 18, 19 year old kid, who just swore that The Phantom Menace is the best one and it's just awesome. And Jar Jar Binks is the best character ever.
Was he using drugs?
It's a generational thing. These are people that saw Phantom Menace when they were probably 3, 4, 5 years old. You know,
see, and that's this is what all of these movies are about to me. All of these kind of cultural things. It's when in your life you saw it.
Yep, that's right.
And you know, so I saw it with my family when I was 8, and I think that made a big impact. And I think, you know, for my kids, it was, you know, when the last Harry Potter book came out, we went to the book release, or when we saw Avengers on opening day, you know, or we're going to go see Star Wars together this weekend. And I think it's, you know, it'll be interesting to see because, hey, we have talked about this a little bit. And I mean, I love Star Wars, the first one, but if you ask me to rank them, I mean, I think I like Empire Strikes Back better.
Okay. Well, that's good. We got both bases covered, and we don't have anybody here that's saying that Phantom Menace was good, right?
No.
No.
That's
okay.
Right.
That's right. So we got it covered. Yeah, I can understand from a filmmaking perspective and an effects perspective and all that, I can understand ranking Empire better. I think that it says something very bad about the first one and the third one from that perspective, because the second is usually the weakest in any trilogy. Because the second of anything out of three has no beginning and no end.
Mm-hmm.
By its very nature, the first of something has a really good beginning, kind of a weak ending usually, like Fellowship of the Ring. And then the middle chapter of anything has no beginning and no end. And then the third chapter of anything usually has kind of a weak beginning and a really big ending, you know, because that's just the nature of a trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's pretty true of Lord of the Rings, at least from my perspective. But
sure.
But it's an indictment to me on the first and the third one if the second one is the best. What do you say to that?
I would say the difference is that I think that's a fair way to explain why the second of most trilogies is not as good. I think the difference in this case is that The Empire Strikes Back is a darker movie. than the other two. And maybe that's the reason I like it, because there is this darker stuff in it. I mean, the Han Solo gets frozen in carbonite, and Luke finds out Darth Vader's his father, gets his hand cut off, and they, you know, they lose the ice battle on Hoth. And and Lando Calrissian betrays his friends and all that. So, I think those are part. But there's other great, great scenes in the middle one that I really love. I love the asteroid scene where they're trying to get away in the Millennium Falcon, and Han Solo is fussing about the hyperdrive not being fixed, and Leia's yelling at him, and they're trying to fix the ship while getting away, flying through the asteroid field, being chased, and
everybody's telling C-3PO to shut up.
Everybody's telling him to shut up, and they go into the cave that turns out to be a giant monster sticking his head out of the rock. So, and we're going to spoil the movies if you haven't seen that. I don't think we can put any kind of spoiler warning on a movie that came out in, 1981. So,
80. Yeah, that one's 80. Yeah.
80.
Yeah, no, that's a fair justification. We'll talk about Empire more in a minute, but that's a fair defense of it. But I look at the first one, and I'm gonna tell you why I like the first one the best, and then we can talk about the first one a little bit. The first one, to me, you didn't need anything else. It didn't need a second chapter. It didn't need a third chapter. It didn't need anything else. It's a movie that starts with one of the greatest beginnings in motion picture history, with the big ship chasing the little ship, one of the greatest, if not the greatest, entrance of a villain in movie history when Darth Vader comes onto Princess Leia's ship.
Mm-hmm.
You go straight from that to the droids being kind of neat. And then from there, you go the introduction of the young hero who's going to learn and grow with Kenobi, Luke and Kenobi, and you get that awesome cantina scene, and then so you get all this stuff building and building and building, and then at the end, you get this fantastic ending where the young hero suddenly gets to show off his flying skills and lead a squadron attack on the Death Star. It's just like a roller coaster. And when that's all done, everybody lives happily ever after. The only good guy that suffers is Ben Kenobi. And even he, we're told, basically becomes even more powerful and all that. He doesn't die. He just becomes a ghost or whatever. He dies. But you know what I mean? He doesn't just die and die. And then at the end, everybody gets everybody but Chewie, which is kind of a ripoff. But the heroes get medals from the princess, and it's the end. I mean, it's a perfect fairy tale. That first movie it starts with, once upon a time, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, and it ends with the princess giving medals to the heroes. It's just a perfect story. It's the perfect movie. So it may not have the effects, the darkness, the layers, the complexity maybe that the second one does, but it has so much. It's just so much of itself. So perfect in so many ways. And let me just say this. I had watched it, the last several times as the night, and we're going to talk about the revised editions in a little bit for a couple of minutes, but I had seen the 1995 updated CGI version the last few times because that was what was out on DVD and everything, which I own. Back on Father's Day, back in, May or June of this year, whenever Father's Day is, we all went in the basement that night and watched the fully restored Renegade cut that's a bunch of people have just poured hours of labor into restoring frame by frame. It's on the internet out there if you want to find it. You can find it. It's totally unauthorized, but it's like they've gone back and pulled in every high definition source they could to restore the original cut. It is such a better movie. I'm telling you, if you are old enough to remember before they started adding stuff to it, before Lucas started changing it, you will not believe how much difference it makes to rip all that stuff out of there and just
you're not telling me anything. It's awful.
Have you gone back and seen the original cut anytime recently?
I haven't gone back and seen it. I don't. You've got I haven't to. Downloaded. I don't own it. But I listen. This is the deal.
Mm-hmm.
They could break the bank tomorrow. by reissuing the three original movies.
Oh, no kidding.
In the original versions, they could make whatever amount of money they wanted to.
Yeah.
And I don't understand why they don't do it.
Well, hold on. Lucas would never do it because it went against his entire justification for fixing them.
Yeah, he doesn't own it anymore.
But he doesn't own
it
anymore.
It's a publicly traded corporation who's, this is a way to make more money.
And Disney understands making money and giving the people what they want.
So at some point in the future, I have to think they're going to do it because it will make money. And at that point, I'll go buy the Blu-ray or whatever the technology is at the time. But I mean, every time I see the updated versions, because that's what I own right now.
Right.
I see every difference.
Yeah.
And some of them I have to keep pointing out to my kids when we watch them, like, this is different. This is not how it is. And I see all the differences every time I watch it. And some of them are like, bamboo shoots under the fingernails.
You owe it to yourself and to your children, John. Go out and get that copy and watch it, and it will blow your mind how much better of a movie it used to be than it is now in its altered form. Well, so Star Wars itself, and I'm always going to think of a Star Wars. I mean, when it first came out, it said Star Wars. It said a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. You know this. I'm just telling the people out there that don't know. And then it said Star Wars, and then it just started with, it is a period of civil war in the galaxy. That was it.
That's right.
There was no episode numbers. There was no subtitle. And I don't like A New Hope anyway. It's a terrible title.
No, those episode and the subtitle weren't added until after
81.
The second movie.
Yeah, they were added in 1981 with that release. And there's other stuff that was changed, too. We'll talk about that. But in fact, one of the first things they changed, this was way before the 1995 revision, one of the first things they changed when they added the subtitle and all that, A New Hope, was they showed Darth Vader regaining control of his TIE fighter.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the original version, and I knew this the minute I saw the second or third release, in the original version, Darth Vader goes spinning off into space when his wingman hits him,
Mm-hmm.
And that's it.
Yeah.
For all you know, he's gone.
Yep.
He doesn't blow up, so you're like, oh, he could still come back. But they went back and said, oh, we're going to do a sequel, and we got to have Darth Vader in it because he's become a cultural phenomenon after that movie came out. So they went back and added that little bit where he kind of steers it away.
Mm-hmm.
They added that totally later. That was the first revision. But the thing from the very beginning, we were talking on Twitter the other day about the movie posters. That Jung poster, that first poster that came out, it was interesting because I thought that different people would have and different ages would have different ideas of which was the most quote unquote iconic Star Wars poster. There's the two that look almost just alike, right? And then there's the one of all the heroes rushing forward, shooting their weapons.
Mm-hmm.
When did you first see that third one with Luke and Ben and Han Solo and all kind of rushing towards you, shooting their guns, right?
That was later.
It was, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember that poster from any theatrical release at all.
I don't either.
No. So which one of the other two? For folks that don't know, there's one that's kind of darker, and it's not as vivid in color. But it's the one that's, to me, that's the most iconic. It's the one that was out when it was at the theater originally. And it's Luke and Leia, standing there on like a rock pile. And and Darth Vader's head is big behind them. And there's the Death Star with the ships flying toward it. And then that one's by Jung. And then there's another version that's the exact same image, but redone completely by the brothers Hildebrandt, who did all those famous fantasy paintings like the Lord of the Rings calendars
mm-hmm.
back then.
Mm-hmm.
You've seen both of those, right? Mm-hmm. What do you make of those two posters?
I mean, I just remember the Jung poster is the one that I identify with as the movie theater poster for the movie. So,
yeah, I wish I knew where the Hildebrandt one came from, because a lot of people, that's the one they remember. And I think it came a little bit later.
It may have. I'm not sure.
And it's weird they did almost the exact same style over again. But see, this is the thing. Younger people look at that and they like the third one, the one with the action. And I get that. But see, that first one had almost like a cosmic. I mean, it was, this was in the wake of 2001, A Space Odyssey and stuff like that. And it just seemed to have a power to it. I mean, it just that struck a chord. Mm-hmm. There were lots of action movies in the 70s with people running around shooting guns, but that original Jung Star Wars poster, it just had some kind of a mystical power to it that just drew me in.
I'd agree with that. And it really, it separated itself. It wasn't a shoot 'em up movie.
Yeah, it had a weight to it, a significance. Like, this really matters. This isn't just like Battle Beyond the Stars or something. This is, you know, this is really portentous and important somehow. It's just how it really is just an amazing poster. So, what else about the first movie kind of, you know, stands out as something that is always going to be memorable and important that we need to talk about? We talked about the cantina scene. The Death Star battle at the end is pretty iconic. I guess the scene with Luke and the two suns in the sky, you know, and that opening scene with the Star Destroyer chasing the little ship and the
Stormtroopers. And the trash compactor, maybe.
Oh yeah, yeah. The trash compactor.
Jumped in the trash compactor.
Yeah, absolutely. It was neat that they did so much stuff on the Death Star.
Mm-hmm.
Like running around, you know, with enemies all around them, you know. But that opening scene, what kind of impact did that have on you with the stormtroopers blasting in and Darth Vader coming in and choking the guy?
I have no idea what the hell's going on. Mm-hmm. The first time I saw that movie, I was like, what the heck is going on here? Who are these people? And mm-hmm. Yeah, where are the good guys?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I mean, it's almost like they're getting pulled over by the authorities, and yet the authorities are clearly evil and mean and brutal and killing people.
That's right. Well, and you know, and then you go from that to the, you know, the droids landing on the planet, and you know, and then you know, that get captured by the Jawas and sold to Luke.
Yeah, the Jawas are awesome too. That's and the Sand People. There's some.
Yep.
That's one of the things about the first movie that I think is so amazing too. Is it's a self-contained story. You never needed anything else, but that first movie. But yet they're the edges of so many other things, right? I mean, you have everything you need for that story, but you also have the outlines, right? The shadows, the edges of so much of a bigger universe that's just out there. That they touch on every so often.
That's right. Well, it's like the cantina with Han and Greedo, and there's obviously this sleazier underworld of the universe too,
mm-hmm.
that exists, you know, beyond regular people and. That they have to go to kind of the black market, you know, to get a ride off the planet away from the authorities. So,
yeah, it's science fiction up to that point had been 90-something% sterile and clean. And, you know, Star Trek gave us this universe where everybody is a happy member of the Federation, mm-hmm. or a mean old Klingon that will blow up, you know, or sick our tribbles on or something. And suddenly Star Wars says, here's this whole underbelly of organized crime and, you know, crime lords and smugglers and pirates and all. You know, we had never really seen very much like that before.
Bounty hunters?
Yeah. Oh, all that stuff. I mean, because even the technology, and this is something people have talked about for years, but the technology was all worn. You know, the rebels, the stuff the rebels had all looked like they'd been, you know, looked like somebody's old Volkswagen. They keep working the motor, you know, working on the motor on it or something.
It all looked used and lived with.
Yeah.
Pristine.
They hadn't gone and bought any of that at the store in the last year or two, right?
Mm-hmm.
That was all stuff that they had really good mechanics keeping up.
Mm-hmm.
But it was all obsolete technology, even though it seemed to work better than a lot of what the Empire had. All right. Well, let's segue then into Empire Strikes Back and talk about it a little bit. We're not going to spend as much time on the prequels or whatever, but I do want to spend a little bit of time on the big ones. And Empire, you know, it's your favorite, so kind of tell me what about it is iconic and all.
First of all, it opens with the great Hoth battle.
Yeah,
I mean, it opens with, you know, Luke gets caught outside by the monster, and again, which is another terrible thing they've kind of added in the movies. You barely see anything of him in the original movie,
mm-hmm.
and in the new versions, you see his whole body and everything. And Han saves him, and but they have the great battle with the AT-AT walkers, which was just the you know, the coolest thing. The battle in the snow with little speeders flying around with the ropes tripping them up and stuff. And they get away, and Princess Leia is on the Millennium Falcon, but it can't go to light speed, so then they're all chasing it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I remember. And
they spend that whole movie with the hyperdrive messed up just so that they're in danger. Because when you've got hyperdrive, you can always get away.
That's right. It is. It really is a get-out-of-jail-free card in a lot of ways. So
yeah.
But that, you know, because it's broken, they have the asteroid chase, and then later they have the bounty. They're bringing the bounty hunters on the,
oh yeah,
you know, on the Imperial ship, and that leads to Boba Fett, you know, chasing them in Cloud City, and then Luke goes to Dagobah and does his, you know, Jedi training stuff with Yoda. Yoda was a completely different character, different kind of character that we had seen in the movie so far, because he was so silly at first.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of goofy, and then ended up being, I mean, obviously ended up being the Jedi Master and teaching Luke. And then
I always called him Space Grover.
Space Grover. Well, and again, as kids who grew up watching the Muppets.
Yeah, it was Frank Oz.
It was very obviously a Muppet.
Yeah. It was very obviously Frank Oz.
It was his handiwork. So.
Yeah, Fozzie Bear, Grover, and Yoda, pretty much.
And then, Luke going and then going to Cloud City, Lando Calrissian was very cool, and then them getting betrayed and Luke showing up and having the big fight with Darth Vader that leads to, you know, his hand getting cut off, and the big line, you know, where he's screaming at Darth Vader about being his father, and then everybody gets away.
Yeah,
Han Solo gets frozen in carbonite.
That's pretty iconic. Yeah, I think that's one of the things about Empire I don't like as much. I do like darker stuff, but I from Star Wars, the first one, it conditioned me the idea the heroes win, everybody gets away happy and gets medals. And in the second one, I didn't want Han Solo. Well, A, I didn't want Han Solo to be with Princess Leia. I wanted Luke to be with Princess Leia. This is before we knew that they were related. Okay.
They kissed in that movie.
I know they Luke and Leia kiss in both the first two movies. Mm-hmm. But I'd waited 3 years to see Luke get the girl. Mm-hmm. And I didn't like Han Solo that much back then. I was little. I wanted the pure good guy, not the kind of gray guy, you know. And although I have to admit, looking back now, that Han Solo became a lot less interesting after Star Wars, in my opinion, because once he becomes a good guy, he's just another good guy. What was interesting about him is when he was a bad guy helping the good guys reluctantly.
Mm-hmm.
That's another reason that I like the first one better than the other two, is because by the third one, Han Solo is entirely a good guy, and he's totally boring.
He's just a regular good guy. He's
a regular guy. In the second one, he's in the process of becoming a regular good guy, so he's still got some gray to him. But in the first one, he's totally a bad guy who's just doing it purely for money and keeps saying over and over, I'm doing it for the money, right?
Just in it for the money.
And
a guy who shoots Greedo first.
Yes, absolutely. First, yeah, that was – I've had students. My students would be like, oh, so did Han shoot first? And I'm like, Han shoot only. There's no first.
The other guy never got a shot off.
Never got a shot off. There's Han shot only. That's it.
Han shot him, kills him, walks out of the bar, flips the bartender a coin, and says, sorry for the mess.
Sorry for the mess. And, you know, honestly, that never was what bothered me as much as just all the little silliness thrown in. It's like Lucas decided that people that were as old as I was and you were when we first saw it needed more wacky Jawas falling off Banthas and stuff. And every time I see that, I'm just like, come on.
Yep.
We're in the middle of a serious story here. I don't need a Jawa that doesn't know how to stand on top of a little elephant.
Well, and then we don't need the scene with Boba Fett in the Millennium Falcon hangar with Han steps on his tail.
Boba Fett's there and he steps on Jabba's tail. Yeah. That's something I was going to ask you a minute ago. Has there ever been another pop culture property where characters can get half a second of screen time and become, you know, million-dollar action figures and iconic and make money for the rest of their lives on the convention circuit?
No.
Boba Fett, has there ever been a character that spent less time on the screen doing anything cool and became more of an iconic character?
No, I love Boba Fett.
Boba Fett is awesome. I've got a T-shirt in there with him on it. But he doesn't do anything. He doesn't do squat. He's in like five seconds of Empire Strikes.
And he dies in the dumbest way. The God, so mad about that.
They've got to do a Boba Fett. I don't know if they are or not, but they've got to do a Boba Fett movie where the movie opens before the titles or anything. The movie opens on the desert.
With him crawling out?
Oh, we see the Sarlacc sitting there going, burp, 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 and all of a sudden, like in at the end of Pacific Rim, mm-hmm. a knife blade comes out and slashes it open from the inside, and Boba Fett walks out, and like James Bond straightening his tie, kind of dusts himself off and walks off into the sunset, and then we start the movie. That's what I want to see.
I'm in.
That would be awesome. That would be so cool. But yeah, I mean, even like you said, IG-88, I mean, he was in literally three frames of The Empire Strikes Back, and he's got action figures, and we're talking about him right now in 2015.
My son is very aware of who he is, too. So.
Isn't that amazing? It's amazing. All right, so that's Empire, and then Jedi came out in 1983. Here's to show you what a big part of our young childhoods these three movies had. Star Wars came out. I was going from third to fourth grade. Empire came out, and I was in the seventh grade. Jedi came out. I had a driver's license.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a 6-year period. That's quite a, you know, important period in a young person's life, and Star Wars was the iconic, seminal, you know, cultural force of those years. Would you agree?
Absolutely.
So Jedi came out. What did you think about Jedi when you saw it in 1983? Were you up, down? What did you think?
I mean, I loved it just because it was a Star Wars movie, and I mean, I loved the first parts where they go to Jabba's palace more than the Ewok parts.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, it's, you know, each one of those movies is kind of in three parts.
Mm-hmm.
And the three sections of Jedi, you've got the Tatooine part, and then you've got, what's the middle part of Jedi?
Well, they're getting ready to do stuff.
And then the last part is when they're on Endor, plus they're on the Death Star.
Yes.
Luke's on the Death Star, right? So, but I mean, did you think of Jedi when you saw it? Did you say, yes, they finished the trilogy off perfectly? Or did you kind of say,
I was happy with how they finished it in the original version.
Yeah. Even with Ewoks?
Again, at the time, I was fine with it.
Okay.
So.
Okay. Well, knowing that, I guess it would have been better if I hadn't known it was supposed to be a planet full of Wookiees.
Yeah.
Because when you know it's supposed to be a planet full of Wookiees and instead you get Ewoks, you're just kind of like, oh. And plus, it was the first time we really saw Lucas start to get goofy.
Yes.
Because there's a lot of stuff that Ewoks do that you just kind of cringe, you know?
Yep. There was some real goofiness.
Yeah, yeah. And that's just going to explode into the prequel trilogy. Ugh. Explode all over us. So, yeah, the speeder bikes, the whole forest speeder bike thing was awesome, wasn't it?
Oh, it was great. I loved it. And I love some of the ways that Ewok fought back with the, you know, the logs coming in and smashing the ad.
Yeah, that was neat.
That kind of thing. But a lot of the, you know, other stuff was, yeah.
Well, knowing that whole thing was Lucas's take on Vietnam, you know, the idea of the high-tech army invading a more primitive people in the jungle. And the primitive jungle people, you know, the less technologically developed jungle people are able to win. I mean, that was always kind of a theme he had through all the movies. The idea of the underdogs with lower technology, you know, their heroics and their virtue carry them through. But that was really the case on Endor. And by the way, I always thought it was funny that the one planet that's completely outdoor is called Endor. But anyway, what about all the Muppets at the beginning of Jedi? I mean, you kind of start with Jedi starts with Muppets and ends with Ewoks. That's kind of its Achilles heel, don't you think?
You talking about Jabba's palace?
Yeah, yeah. And they overdid that in the remakes.
Oh my gosh, the remakes parts of that with the singing and stuff is just. But I mean, the original version is not so much of that,
right?
And I enjoy that. I mean, I had the fight, you know, with Luke in the pit. You know, under Jabba's palace against the big guy where he jabs the bone in his mouth and stuff. The Rancor.
Yeah, yeah, the Rancor.
You know, that's a good, that's a really good scene, and I like the whole the battle at the Sarlacc pit with all of that stuff. So I mean, I really enjoy the Jabba stuff. I mean, it does get kind of goofy. The guards are kind of goofy, and how they kill everybody is a little bit much, but again, the Boba Fett dying thing just still bothers me. But those are great scenes, and that's my favorite part of that movie. So
yeah, I think that one of the reasons that the first two are remembered so highly compared to the other four now, the first two about as goofy or as bad as cringeworthy as you ever get in the first two is just C-3PO being annoying.
Yes.
Whereas in Jedi and the prequels, you get. In all four of them, honestly, to varying degrees and numbers, in all four of them, starting with Jedi, there are moments that you're like, that is awesome. And then almost immediately there are moments that you're like, oh, why did they put that in there? And every one of them has got their moments. I mean, we're going to roll on into the prequels in a minute. We'll talk about them. There's not nearly as much good to talk about, I don't think. But, yeah, Jedi is where Lucas started to kind of get full control and not let anybody else tell him no.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the revised editions came out in 1995, 1996, 1997 in preparation for Phantom Menace in 99. And I got to tell you, I was teaching a joint enrollment class in Atlanta in Rockdale County in Conyers in 95 when the revised special edition, whatever they call it, of Star Wars came out. And I was teaching a class out there at the end of the class period, like at the high school. The college sent me out to the high school to teach a class. Mm-hmm. And my students were all like, Star Wars just came out. And I'm like, you guys have never seen it at the theater, have you? And they're like, no. And I'm like, and they're like, we should all go. And I said, okay. So we all went out and jumped in our cars. I can't get fired for this now. I don't work for that college anymore. We all jumped in our cars, drove all the way from Conyers to Lawrenceville, 45 minutes. And we all, my whole class together and me, went and saw Star Wars, the revised 95 edition, on the big screen in Lawrenceville. And we came out, and those 18-year-olds were all just in awe. Even though it was the revised version with the changes and everything, they had never seen it on a big screen like that.
Mm.
In 1995, even the TVs weren't that big,
Sure.
So they were blown away. And that's hard to believe that was 20 years ago.
Wow.
20 years ago, the revised editions came out. I would say that just about everything in the revised editions was a mistake, except two things. If they actually went and cleaned up the matte lines and the sketchy effects in a few places of spaceships.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's okay, right? I mean, that's just tidying up. That's like a restoration of an old movie.
Yeah, I was fine with that kind of stuff.
And the other, and I want to get your opinion on this. The other thing that they changed that I actually thought was a vast improvement because it was something that had bothered me since the moment I saw the original was the very end of Return of the Jedi. Because the original end of Return of the Jedi is just the Ewoks celebrating.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. And I kept thinking, well, what about the Empire? If this is the last movie and we're not going to get any more for a long time, I want to know what happened to the Empire. What happened to the fleet? What happened to all the planets where there were Grand Moffs and stuff? Well, all we got was Ewoks shooting fireworks. But if you go and look at the revised version of Jedi, you see people celebrating on Cloud City. You see people celebrating on Coruscant, all over the galaxy. And I was like, yes, this is what I wanted to see back in 1983. What's your reaction to that?
See, but then it goes a step further, and there's Jimmy Smits celebrating,
yeah.
And Anakin Skywalker is, pictured as the ghost when the
now they added that in yet another edition in 1990. They hadn't cast what's his name yet in 1997 when Jedi came out the revised. That was when they released it on video that they added Christian Haydenson.
So I mean, I don't have a big problem with that. I think it was kind of fun the first time I saw that, and I agree with you that it did. Show people celebrating in other places, and you had a sense of the Empire was really over.
Yeah, some closure.
Yeah.
that's all I wanted was a little closure. And I mean, I've never had have had many other people agree. I mean, people usually just either they like all the changes or they don't like any of the changes. But I just felt like that was actually one that Lucas should have included originally. Just give us some sense of the larger galaxy, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm okay with that.
Yeah. All right, so that's the revised editions, and that was all, you know, we had that, what came out on DVD and then on Blu-ray and all that. The prequels, 1999, we got The Phantom Menace. 2002, we got Attack of the Clones, and then 2005, we got the Revenge of the Sith. Were you just over the moon ready for Phantom Menace when it came out before you saw it?
Yes, because it was a Star Wars movie and it was coming out, so I was fired up.
Mm-hmm. And what did you think when you saw it the first time?
You know, my immediate reaction was, hey, that was fun. It was a Star Wars movie. And then as I sat down, then over the next 24, 48 hours, I kind of thought about the whole thing and I was like,
I think that's what a lot of people said. I mean, you know, I knew a lot of people and –
you know, it's like in the flush of the moment, I was like, man, that was great. There was lightsabers, you know?
Right, right. There were Jedi Knights fighting droids and stuff. Yeah, yeah, there was Darth Maul. Yeah.
And I was like, man, that one guy was really goofy.
Well, you know, I knew a lot of people back then that defended this movie for days, weeks, months. But eventually, just about every one of them finally admitted to me in a very soft voice, yeah, it sucked.
I mean, again, let's compare it to the other two.
Well, this is my least favorite of all of them.
Really?
Phantom Menace, ugh.
You like second and third ones better than that one?
Yeah, just because the stuff that happens in the first one is so egregiously, offensively bad, annoying to me as a Star Wars fan. I mean, it just to me, it does not get any worse than Jake Lloyd driving his
pod racer,
having a NASCAR race with a two-headed alien doing the play-by-play. I mean, at that point, I just wanted to get up and leave. I thought, how far have we come from speeder bikes and trash compactors and, you know, and asteroids to a two-headed alien at a NASCAR race on another planet? And then Jar Jar and the little flying Watu or whatever, and just the aliens were goofy. It just the whole thing reeked of like preschool.
Mm-hmm.
And I you know, like I said, there are moments in all six that are awesome, and the whole thing with Darth Maul is fantastic. But he gets a little bit of a Boba Fett treatment where he does get to do a little bit of cool stuff before he's totally removed from the movies.
If the Darth Maul thing really bothers you, you got to go back and watch the Star Wars Clone Wars. So that's all I'm going to say.
Okay. Yeah, I haven't seen that. Well, you know, it's neat because – well, wait a minute. Tell me before – I got to explore something. Now, I'm going to get into the people versus George Lucas really quickly but that addressed this. But what – you liked Phantom Menace more than both of the other two prequels or what?
Definitely better than the third one. I mean, a lot of my problems with the prequels is Hayden Christensen.
Okay.
I don't like him.
Okay.
I mean, I think he's stiff and not – I think he's not a very good actor.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was a poor choice for the part.
He's as poor an actor as a grown-up as Jake Lloyd was as a kid. Ba-dum-bum.
Yeah. But, I mean, I think – so, I mean, I don't love him as Anakin.
Right.
And I think his kind of woodenness – you know, is not convincing whether he's supposed to be in love or in pain or turning evil or whatever. And I think the whole idea, again, the one part of the plot of the first three movies that I really appreciate is the idea that the Emperor set up the whole crisis to get him, you know, as the senator, voted emergency power so that he takes over the regular government to fight against this threat that he created.
Mm-hmm.
as Darth Sidious.
Right.
And so he's basically playing both sides off to increase his power on both sides.
Yeah.
That he engineered the entire crisis to collapse the government and give him ultimate power. I really appreciate that plan.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and the way he executed it. But, you know, the other parts, I mean, the droid armies, the, how goofy they are, and especially when you get the combination of the droid armies and 3PO all the time.
Roger, roger.
And Jar Jar. Yeah, roger, roger. Yeah. And so, I mean, I like the fight scene and the, you know, the kind of arena fight scene.
Mm-hmm.
Where the, you know, all the Jedi show up to rescue him and stuff. And Jango Fett meets his, you know, too untimely end. But it just, you know, the third one, like the, you know, the fight, the Ben Kenobi Anakin fight, and the third one, the stuff with Anakin and Padme, and I mean, I just didn't, it didn't move the needle for me.
Well, one of the problems that I had with the latter two, the episodes 2 and 3 in particular, because Phantom Menace was removed enough from everything else. It was its own little world there for a while. You know, it was Padme and the little boy and all that, and the two Jedi. That was fine. But as they get closer to what we already know, right, as they get closer to Star Wars, it had to start fitting an existing storyline.
Yeah, this is the other problem, is they're trying to not just make it fit, but make it perfectly fit.
Yeah.
Like, everybody has to be in exact position.
Right.
And I thought it was a little trying to make it a little too neat.
Yeah. They wanted it to be able to watch them in order and it work. And it actually just – what it does – I've always said this is, you know, any story has to be told basically by the characters. You can't force characters to behave against the established nature you've made for them in order to fit a pre-existing story. Mm. You know, you can't draw the map and then force the characters to follow the map. You have to create the characters, and then they go where they're going to go on the blank map, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you already know the destination, you're kind of having to herd them. Mm-hmm. And it's very obvious in a movie when because you only got a couple of hours, you know, you got to move them. And so TV is different. Like a 20-episode TV season, you've got lots of time for them to wander around like herding cats, kind of. That looks a little more organic. But in a 2-hour movie, you've got to herd those cats very artificially toward the exit. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, absolutely.
And it's very visible that you're doing it. And so that was a problem I had, and increasingly with those movies, is that the characters act more and more out of character in order to fit the plot. That's a problem I see in a lot of movies these days. I see that over and over, especially in big budget sci-fi type movies where the creators come up with scenes that are really cool, that are visual, that they want to happen, and then they have to invent a reason why the characters would do that. And it always jumps out, you know, they wouldn't do this. They had to do it for the story. So I think that the prequels, increasingly as you go along, suffer from that. But honestly, I didn't think the second one and third one were any worse. At least it didn't have a pod race, you know.
No, but again, like, the
didn't have as much Jar Jar, though he does. Like,
there was some Jar Jar,
a little bit, yeah.
They used Jar Jar as the patsy to give the Emperor the vote,
yeah.
You know, which great. I thought was fitting, I guess, but
yeah,
you know, and then they Anakin go in and like kill all the Jedi children and stuff. I don't know.
Well, see again, yeah. See, that's something that we knew from the lore had to happen, but when it happens in the movie, it doesn't feel real. It doesn't feel organic. It feels like they said, well, they're checking off things on a list. And they said, oh, it's time for him to do this. Well, his character's not really there yet. Well, too bad he has to do it anyway.
That's what I'm saying. Like, he goes from like good guy who's kind of torn to I'm going to murder these children I know.
So. Yeah, like 2 seconds. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So. And Padme goes from strong female leader to, oh, I'm going to die because my boyfriend or my husband, you know, is being weird. You know, I mean, they kind of messed up the characters in order to fit the story. That just was disappointing to me. There's a movie. Have you seen The People versus George Lucas?
No.
You need to watch that. That's a very good. It's a documentary, came out several years ago. where some people that really love Star Wars just kind of went through and they interview people all over the world, from just people like you and me to actual people involved in the movies and everything. And they basically just talk about what was your reaction to the prequels and, you know, who do you assign blame to, what went wrong and why. And it really is good. I was fascinated by it, hearing all these people's opinions. So many people in it say how they went into Phantom Menace all excited, and it took them two or three showings to really go. You know, it's so funny. So many of them say, well, I came out of the first showing of Phantom Menace, and I was like, was it really as bad as I think it was? I must have imagined it. I got to go see it again. And they go see it again, and they're like, no, it was bad, but I'm going to go see it one more time. And I'm thinking, if every movie that's as bad as The Phantom Menace, people would go see four or five times just to make sure it was bad, movies would make a lot more money.
Get that right.
So The Phantom Menace made about $1 billion, mostly on people that just couldn't believe their own eyes. George Lucas is like, who are you going to believe, me or your own eyes, your lying eyes? So, yeah, check out The People versus George Lucas. That's a really interesting indictment. But it's the thing. It's from a point of love, right? They love the property. They're just trying to figure out what screwed up. So,
sure.
Let me pause right here and say I've got a few audio clips from some friends of the show, and I believe the first one will be Will Collier, who's a friend of ours that's done a lot of. He's written columns for different online sources, and he's also does an Auburn-related football column, but he's a big Star Wars fan, about this, going back about as far as you and me. And he sent me in a clip, and then I got a few others that'll be identified. So let's get those on here for just a second.
A long time ago, in a multiplex far, far away. Actually, it was early June of 1977 at the Mall Garden Twin, now long gone and turned into an antique store, in Albertville, Alabama. I was 8 years old, fresh out of the second grade, and the movie, of course, was Star Wars. That movie was all I'd ever wanted, even before I knew what I wanted out of a movie. It was flash and bang and glorious vistas and scary monsters and fantastic spaceships and heroes and villains and magic and laser swords and a princess and a knight and talking robots, all walked up and wrapped up in stirring music in a vast epic scale. Star Wars hit me with all its extraordinary, playful velocity at just the right age. I and most of my contemporaries have never been the same. In retrospect, we never had a chance. On the eve of the first new Star Wars movie in 10 years, and the at-long-last continuation of the original story, why are so many of us so captivated by these movies? What has the power to keep drawing millions back to those long-ago, faraway worlds? As was said about 1999's Episode I, The Phantom Menace, The Force Awakens is the most eagerly anticipated movie of all time. People have literally been waiting in line to see it for weeks. Why? Nobody acted like this over, say, The Godfather Part 3 or Jurassic Park The Lost World, and a good thing, too, since both of those movies were awful. Hollywood's been trying for nearly 35 years to duplicate the success of Star Wars by dumping millions into movies with stunning visuals and lousy plots. The Black Hole, Tron, Flash Gordon, The Fifth Element, Batman and Robin, the list of bad science fiction movies since Star Wars could go on forever. Even entertaining movies with great effects like Independence Day or the original Jurassic Park have come and gone, generating millions in box office receipts, but barely leaving a mark on the culture. Star Wars is different. There's something about these movies that touches a very primal chord in people. The underlying story itself, the hero's journey, has antecedents in cultures as diverse as Japanese, Hindu, and American Indian legends, as well as the Western classics. There's literally something in these movies for every culture, because they were written with themes taken out of ancient legends from all over the world. Star Wars unabashedly celebrates the values of friendship, family, self-sacrifice, loyalty, and love. It's very difficult today to find many popular entertainments that even take such things seriously, much less hold them up as worthy ideals. These movies are special, though, not just because of the grand themes or the mythic underpinnings. They reach us by honestly appealing to emotions rarely appreciated in this pessimistic age. These are stories that, for all their extra-worldly trappings, celebrate the most basic elements of humanity. When I look back over the first three films, two individual scenes have always stood out for me. In purely emotional impact, I don't think you can top farm boy Luke Skywalker watching a sunset in Star Wars, or Yoda lifting his spaceship out of a swamp in The Empire Strikes Back. Both are short scenes with no dialogue or sophisticated special effects to speak of. Their power comes from the simple but perfectly shot visuals and the soaring John Williams score, and from the primal emotions of wonder evoked by them. And last, and maybe best of all, these are great entertainments. I still remember my dad walking out of the first film, after nearly a decade of grim 70s cinema, and exclaiming, "It's been forever since I went to a movie that was fun." It's difficult to express how much I'm looking forward to seeing the new movie. The very best moment of The Phantom Menace was in November of 1998, when a bootleg version of the first trailer escaped to dial-up internet. It was sheer magic, for 2 minutes. Sadly, it was also the final single moment of the prequel trilogy. I don't know whether The Force Awakens will be everything I want it to be. As in 1999, I don't know if it's humanly possible for any movie to live up to the expectations for a new Star Wars film. But I do know that there's an 8-year-old somewhere inside who's going to have a hard time sleeping Thursday night.
Now, last thing, John, before we wrap up for the night, as we are at the hour mark here, roughly, what do you hope to see? We know nothing about 7. I mean, I haven't even watched except for the first trailer. So I may even have to take my headphones off while you talk if you're going to say anything beyond the first trailer.
But no, believe me, I'm not going to spoil anything.
I've been avoiding everything, and it's been hard because there have been spoilers in the stores.
Oh, yeah, no, I don't walk in the toy section anymore.
Target's trying to spoil me on this movie. It's ridiculous. So just in general, what are you kind of hoping to see that would get things back on track with 7, Force Awakens?
Well, I mean, the idea is what happened after, you know, 6. I mean, what happened after the Death Star blew up the second time and the Emperor died? Clearly, there were still Imperial fleets and armies out there, and they didn't all just lay down their arms and surrender. So what happened? You know, how did the rebels try to, you know, turn it into a new government, and what happened with the, you know, fighting against these fleets? And then, you know, there's been all this great fan fiction and or real books and stories and comics over the years that have tried to fill in these blanks, but now all that's been wiped out of the canon.
Yeah.
And they're giving us the definitive answer. So I'm excited to see that.
I'm glad I never bought or read hardly any of it. I read some of the Star Wars comics that Marvel did back in the day, and those were always fun. But I've never I read the Timothy Zahn. I need to get him on the show sometime. I see him every year at Dragon Con. We watch robot battles together. Timothy Zahn wrote that trilogy, the Heir to the Empire, whatever trilogy, with Admiral Thrawn.
Admiral Thrawn.
I read those three, and I have never read anything else since then in the Star Wars universe. I just never really wanted to.
There was another one that came out right about the same time after the movies called Splinter of the Mind's Eye.
Oh, that's a whole other thing. All right, now, hold on. Splinter of the Mind's Eye, real quick, for those that don't know, is an Alan Dean Foster novel. Alan Dean Foster is one of the great novelization writers, you know, media tie-in novels. One of my dear friends in publishing, and then one of my dear friends, Keith DeCanada, he's been on the show before, he does that too, and he's excellent at it. And there's Peter David does a lot of it. But Alan Dean Foster is kind of one of the deans of the media tie-in business. He ghost wrote the Star Wars novel for George Lucas. It only says George Lucas, but Alan Dean Foster wrote it. And so Lucas had a story idea if Star Wars barely made its money back, right? If Star Wars had made back about what they spent on it, and he had to do a cheap sequel, he was going to do Splinter of the Mind's Eye. Well, when Star Wars made $1 billion, I think it made $400 million, which back then was like $2 billion. Mm-hmm. When Star Wars made $400 million initially, they said we're going to go ahead and make Empire Strikes Back, a big budget, you know, expansive saga. And they took in, I guess, 78, 79, Lucas took the outline he had for the cheap sequel and gave it to Alan Dean Foster and just basically said, write a book out of this. It's one of those things where when I read it as a kid, I loved it. What did you think about it when you were a kid?
I really enjoyed it.
Don't go back and read it again. Because I haven't. Okay, I read it in 78, 79, 80, somewhere in there.
Yes, that's about when I read it.
And I remember thinking it was really awesome. But I've had so many people since then tell me, oh, it's so bad. So hang on to those memories, because apparently it didn't age well. It's basically Luke and Leia and C-3PO, right? And maybe Chewbacca, maybe? Running around on a jungle planet and they fight Darth Vader at the end, and he falls
there's
in a hole.
Kind of gem that has something to do with the Force.
Yeah, that was totally written out of the story. But yeah, that's the other thing. But that was way back in the 70s. I mean, as far as like after Jedi came out, we got nothing new Star Wars. There was the Thanksgiving special, remember, back in 78, which
oh yes,
the least said the better. I've got a video copy of it downstairs, VHS. But there was nothing Star Wars between Jedi in 83 and Heir to the Empire in 91, pretty much. We went like 8 years with nothing. And then when those three came out, they were huge successes, and it kind of reignited the fire that eventually led up to the reissues in 95, 96, 97, and then the prequel. So, those books attempted to kind of tell us where things were going, but Force Awakens seems like it really is just going in a completely different direction. It's got new characters. It's got different stormtroopers from what I'm seeing in the trailer. What do you kind of make of it? Just speculation, not spoiler.
I mean, my speculation is that, you know, you got units or fleets or whoever, commanders from different parts of the galaxy who are now struggling for control of Imperial forces, both with the rebels and maybe with each other. Mm. You know, you don't have to assume that there's a unified command structure still in effect for the Empire, that maybe they don't all get along or they're not working together. And so they're, but at the same time, they know that, the rebels are a danger, so they're trying to deal with them in some way.
Is there presumably now, instead of the Rebel Alliance, some sort of New Republic, do you think?
I think they have to, at some point, if you win, you have to turn it into a government and try and, undo some of the evil the Empire did. So.
Yeah. Well, it looks interesting. I mean, from what little I've seen, there's some interesting looking characters. We have some kind of new droid that people are kind of going bonkers over, and there's kind of a Darth Vader looking character that's kind of neat, and it looks like we all kind of know that some of the original characters actors come back. I mean, that's not any kind of a secret. You can't turn on the TV without hearing that. Yeah, we'll close with this. J.J. Abrams. I mean, could you have thought of anybody you'd rather have doing it than him? I mean,
no, I'm happy he's doing it. I mean, I enjoyed the Star Trek movie he did, but he's more. I mean, you and I've talked about this in terms of Star Trek. He's more of a Star Wars-y kind of guy.
Yeah,
he's more of an explosion and battles and intense action guy than a Star Trek kind of guy.
Yeah, I mean, I liked the first Star Trek movie he did okay. It was goofy, it was funny, it had some charm to it. It was okay, but the second was an abomination. The second was horrible. It had nothing to do with Star Trek, and I just couldn't stand it. The only thing it had to do with Star Trek was copying, just flat copying scenes and moments from the original movies, which I'm like, that's just the laziest thing I've ever seen. And Star Trek is supposed to be about science and the future and exploration. It's not about a war. That's not its primary focus. So I agree that they're two completely different properties, and maybe this will be a better fit for him than Star Trek was.
The other part is Abram is, roughly our age.
Yeah.
And grew up on it, and he feels the same way about Star Wars that we do. So I know that he wants it to work.
Yeah. Well, we will see. When are you going to go see it?
We're seeing it Sunday morning.
Okay. All right.
Sunday, noonish or 11 a.m., something like that.
We've got tickets for like 5:30 Friday, 4 days from now, less than four days from now. And we're taking Mira, so our little 7-year-old is going to get to go. She's so excited. She went to see Guardians of the Galaxy with us, and parts of it kind of scared her a little bit and all, but hopefully this won't mess her up too much because she loves Star Wars. We watched all 6 of them back last summer, so she's ready to go now. The last thing I'm going to say is every other big movie this year came out in Europe like 2 or 3 weeks before it opened here, and I got tons of spoilers, and I also heard all the reviews, even though I was trying to avoid them. Spectre got totally spoiled, reviews and everything. Avengers Age of Ultron came out weeks earlier in Europe. I haven't seen any reviews, anything. I'm thinking that this movie's opening in the United States first.
I think it is too, but I'm telling you, it's opening Thursday night, so you need to turn the internet off.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is anybody out there who's a serious, who loves Star Wars, and I'm not going to be on Twitter. I'm not going to be on the internet starting Thursday night until I've seen it.
That's smart. That's smart. Yeah, I wonder why this one is opening in the United States first.
I think because they know that that would be a real problem.
Well, I think maybe part of it, really think about it, if you get on like Box Office Mojo or Box Office Profits and look at the at the money, Star Wars is like the one franchise that makes more of its money in the United States than in the rest of the world. Everything else seems to make more, like Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter. Those movies all do better in Britain and in Europe and in Asia all put together than they do in the United States. Mm. The only ones that do, if I remember correctly, the only properties that do better in the United States than in the rest of the world are Batman, Spider-Man, and Star Wars. Mm-hmm. Those do better in the United States. And so it may be that they know that, and they think if we open it in Europe first, it will be not as big of an opening because they don't like it as much for some reason over there. But if we open it first in the United States, it'll have a big opening, and then we take it out there, you know?
I think it's going to have a gigantic opening weekend.
I do, too. What was funny, this movie, 2 months ago, this movie made more money in one weekend in advance sales on Fandango than the Fantastic Four movie made in its entire run.
You're saying that like it's a bad thing.
Oh, I'm not. I think it's hilarious, though. I think it's an indictment on Fox. They need to give the Fantastic Four back to Marvel yesterday. But all right. Well, I think we've covered pretty much everything. And do you have any last Star Wars thoughts to send our listeners out there off to the theater in the next few days?
No, I just, like when I was a kid, I'm excited about taking my kids to this movie and seeing it with them like you are. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a big part of it, seeing Star Wars together and stuff. So that's what I'm really excited about. And I can't wait to see where they go with it. And then, because then we'll turn to what we think about it and where we think they're going from here.
Yeah. So that'll wrap up this episode, and you guys tune in about a week or week and a half or so, and John and I will be back to give you our immediate review and reaction. And if you haven't seen it yet, just don't listen to that episode. But that episode will be our immediate reaction review. We did one. I did one for Spectre already, and I did one for Age of Ultron, but John's going to join me for this one. I'm really excited. I don't have to just do an hour of me talking. I actually have somebody talking too. All right. So check out part two of this in about a week. And in the meantime, may the Force Awaken be with you. And John, the rocket's going to get out of here for another week. Thanks for coming on.
All right. It was fun, man.
All right. We're going to wrap up, and we'll see you guys next week.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.